You're listening to the Healthcare Goes Digital podcast. Get ready to be inspired as we explore provocative topics surrounding innovative technologies and ideas with top industry professionals as we help to positively disrupt healthcare. At Impetus Digital, we believe that everything starts with a thought as we aspire to act as the bridge to ignite these courageous conversations, both through our Insight platform and through these fireside chats. Let's get started with your host, Natalie Eden, Managing Director and co-owner of Impetus Digital, an all-in-one virtual collaboration solution for online meetings, events, and advisory boards.
Hello, everybody. My name is Natalie Eden, and I'm one of the managing directors and co-owners of Impetus Digital. For those people who don't know what Impetus Digital does, we have actually built some of the best-in-class asynchronous and synchronous virtual collaboration tools. We allow and assist life science companies to be able to interact, collaborate, share, and to create work with all of their different stakeholders, be it physicians, payers, allied healthcare providers, and patients, through a myriad of different options and opportunities, things like advisory boards, investigator meetings, payer standing boards, educational programs, and unfortunately, also because of COVID-19, we've been helping a lot of companies virtualize their POA brand rollouts, sales and MSL training, et cetera, et cetera. So what we really believe at Impetus is that everything starts with a thought, and a thought leads to a courageous conversation. And we at Impetus want to be the bridge for some of these really big, hairy, audacious goals that life science companies are ailing to do, especially in this time and place with this new normal that we're experiencing. And by having some of these courageous conversations with disruptive thinkers like the Scott Errols of the world, we can all work collectively to positively disrupt healthcare. So I'm very pleased to be introducing our guest today on our channel, and his name is Scott Errol. He is actually the CEO of the New Zealand Health IT, or we're going to call it from now on, NZHIT. This is actually a not-for-profit incorporated society that was actually formed in 2002, so it's been around for a really long time. And it's grown to become the peak body for the New Zealand digital health industry sector. So we're going to go into this, but Scott has done a phenomenal job of bridging and bringing a community of various stakeholders and digital stakeholders into the same space. So really exciting work that he's been doing. And as earlier this year, he's also become a part-time podcaster. We were just chatting about that for a bit, unfortunately because of COVID-19, but I think it's really catching on. And it's a popular podcast. It's called Digital Health Insights with Scott Errol. And that's how I discovered him. So as part of this podcast, he interviews key thought leaders from New Zealand and really across the globe on all things that are digital health. So welcome, Scott. So happy to have you here as a guest today.
Well, thanks very much, Natalie. And man, that's an impressive interview. Are you sure you've got the right guest?
It's wonderful. And I just want to say, a very impressive grouping. I was, just perusing through your website and looking at the number of partners and the people that have come in from the community that are very interested in this sector. Why don't you tell us a little bit and give us a summary about why you created this in the first place? What was the inception and the drive to put NZHIT together?
Well, initially, so going back to 2002, obviously I wasn't involved back then, with this organization. I've been in this role for 6 years now. But originally in 2002, it was formed to bring together what was or would have been sort of the pioneers in New Zealand in terms of digital health. So there was the likes of Ian McRae of Orion Health and Tom Bowden from HealthLink and a few others. There was about only 6 to 8, I believe, who decided that they wanted to kind of form an association. And the primary reason for it at the time was for export. So they were designing and building digital solutions for the healthcare sector in New Zealand and finding that what they were developing was, you know, there was a demand offshore for it as well. And they combined with what we call in New Zealand, our government agency called New Zealand Trade and Enterprise, and then also our Ministry of Health. So they all sort of got together and said, let's form this association with the primary purpose to assist these industry operators to export what they're building. And that's how it got started. And because it's had various sort of iterations during that time. And so when I arrived 6 years ago, and let me say, my background's not in technology. So I always hasten to add, you know, I would be the last chap you'd want to put in front of a keyboard and ask the right code. goodness knows what you'd get as a result. My background, though, is in the healthcare delivery in New Zealand as a manager, not as a clinician. And a lot of that background's been in aged care, whether it's retirement village or a rest home hospital, and then also community care or home-based care. So my background's very much in terms of what I call sort of being at the coalface to do provide care to people at a vulnerable time of their life. And frankly, whenever we're sick, it is a vulnerable time of our lives, and regardless of who we are and what age we may be. So then I arrived on the scene for this role when the membership had sort of gone into a bit of a decline. It sort of lost its way to a degree. And there was about 60 members. Then over the last 6 years, I've sort of set about sort of changing the direction of, somewhat, and membership now is up to just over 150. And of course, our membership is predominantly organizational. So we, you know, we have 150 organizational members. And then of course, within our database, they can have as many of their people on the database that get the newsletters and the invites to events and all those sort of things. So there's well over 1,000 sort of people on our database. Predominantly, most of them will be domiciled in New Zealand. And the change that I sort of brought to it was to change, because of my background in healthcare delivery, was really to sort of change the, or broaden out the membership so that we could become more understanding of the challenges in the health sector, and then come up, make sure that the software that was being developed actually was an identification of particular problems. And rather than, you know, sort of create a solution, then try to convince the market that they've got the problem, you know, engage with the market first, or in this case, the health sector first, and find out what the real problems are, and then work with them to come up with solutions for them. And so broadening out the membership meant that bringing in non-IT, so but care providers. So and we've got a range now. So about 75% of our membership is what I would call digital health companies or organizations, and from big to small. And then there's the other 25% are healthcare providers. So we've got quite large aged care providers that are members, and what we call PHOs, or primary health organizations, who represent general practice and primary care in New Zealand. And then also the Ministry of Health, what we call the Accident Compensation Commission, which is our ACC. We have a no-faults sort of accident insurance platform in New Zealand. Platform's probably not the right word. And then we've got some of the two major private insurers in New Zealand, which is NIB Insurance and Southern Cross. So they are insurers and providers of healthcare. And that's what sort of started the change, really, was to kind of become the glue, or I think the Americans might refer to a glue guy when it comes to sport. And so I saw myself as being that and playing that role so that I could start to connect various parts of the sector, particularly where there are specific problems that IT or digital could really, with innovation and building on the platforms that are already in place, that they could start to work as real enablers of healthcare delivery.
So that's a fascinating approach, and kudos to you to becoming the glue and bringing in such an arrayed and varied and important and productive group of stakeholders around the table. And when you brought those partners in, how did you go about getting an understanding about what the problem set was, and to determine the key priorities of the organization?
Yeah, in a way, that was probably the easy part because having been, you know, having spent at least, 14 or 15 years in healthcare delivery in New Zealand, so add to the last 6 years, I've sort of been, you can tell by my grey hair and bald patch that I've been in healthcare for far too long. But, you know, because actually I'm only about 30 years old, but it does, you know, healthcare sort of precincts all over the world do tend to age us, I believe. But anyway, that part of it was relatively easy because I kind of had an understanding anyway, and I targeted those, let's say, segments of the health sector that I knew had particular problems that weren't being addressed properly. And so again, aged care, primary care, home-based care, those sort of areas. When it comes to hospitals, and I think it's similar in various parts of the world, but in New Zealand, you know, the systems were fairly well embedded, and I wouldn't say that they were specifically solving, you know, exactly the problems in place, but, you know, hospital systems, you know, that might have been installed 10 or 15 years ago, still in use. Probably one of the main areas there was to kind of put some what I call positive tension on the need to upgrade and have systems up to date. That was probably one of the biggest issues that I found in let's say the secondary care side. So I just focused on these other, primarily focused on these other parts of the health sector, and then started to, from one aspect, bringing those members in, so non-IT, so healthcare providers, were increasingly interested in what can IT do just to run my business, number one, but then specifically, what can it do to help to enable the delivery of care or my model of care to my patients, clients, or customers. So then I was then talking with our software side of things in our membership and saying, actually, and sort of a little bit of tough love, frankly, in the early days, and saying, hey, look, actually, I need to tell you this, but what you've just developed isn't relevant. It could be if you actually were prepared to flex and change. And let me put you in touch with somebody who I know has a particular problem that I think you could help. But you're going to have to be prepared. Don't try to sell the snake oil. Go in with an open mind and open ears and actually listen to what the problem really is first. And once that started to gain momentum, it just sort of, you know, it was really sort of gained its own life, frankly.
That's really, really interesting. I think what's also really intriguing for people who might be listening to this from other parts of the world is New Zealand probably has a very interesting ecosystem in the healthcare and in the digital space, and that, you know, really just in terms of the size of the country. And, you know, the fact that you are custodians of almost 100% of New Zealand's health-related data. So this puts you in a very interesting opportunity that isn't necessarily afforded by so many other countries, including Canada, which has a lot of disparate different buckets and data lakes. Not everybody is conducive to sharing. You know, the US has similar issues and other sorts of things. How is New Zealand leveraging the fact that there's a central database that can be utilized for clinical studies, for population health management, et cetera? So what is being done in that area since you have that fantastic opportunity?
Well, firstly, you know, don't let me paint it like it's a perfect and glossy picture, because it isn't. But we do have I think you'll be referring to the NHI, or that we have the National Health Identifier. So we do have that advantage, I suppose, over lots of other countries where a long time ago, it would be well over 20 years ago, a decision was made. It was a very forward-thinking decision, you know, to establish the NHI system. And so that we, you know, I've got an NHI number. I happen to know what it is, which is a good thing. But, we don't walk around with an identity card, or we don't have it tattooed on us somewhere. It's really a lot of New Zealand citizens or people living in New Zealand won't know their NHI, but they don't necessarily have to. So they, you know, if they've signed up with their general practice, their primary care provider, and it's all recorded at that stage. So you don't have to, you're encouraged to register with a primary care provider, a general practitioner, a GP, as we call them here. And in doing so, then you know, if you don't have an NHI, which would nowadays would be if you were a baby, just pretty much a newborn, then that NHI is allocated to you. And then it kind of travels with you as you grow and as you age. You don't necessarily have to know what it is. And most don't, to be honest. Of course, if you're working in the health system, you probably do, and you probably should. So that has given us an advantage over time. And it's in recent times, over that time, I would say that the system itself was kind of not invested in. And so it did get to a point where it was very hard to access. So if you were wanting to develop, say, something innovative, or even if you were a healthcare provider and needed access to the NHI registry, it was very difficult to do that. And it did become quite a problem. But I think in the last, last 2 to 3 years, there's been a lot of effort and investment put in bringing it up to speed, updating it, actually creating API layers that could then make it more accessible, maintaining the privacy of it, of course, is extremely important to do that. So it has provided, and it will, it's been continually now worked on, that it's quite exciting. I think that we're actually going to see far more innovation as a result of being able to utilize NHIs that are non-identifiable. You know, so data coming out of that is not identified to a specific person. But research is already using it. We're starting to see quite a bit of activity now as a result of what was a decision really that was made well over 20 years ago.
Yeah, and it definitely is very forward thinking. And in that situation, are you finding that New Zealand is being utilized as an experimental ground for new strategies, minimally viable products by, for example, AWS's or other tech companies? How are people leveraging that database and other ones that are being created as interoperable interfaces with a more global tech ecosystem?
That's an interesting question, a difficult one to answer in a way, because we don't have a fully interoperable environment yet, and we have it. It's better than what it was, and it's sort of developing in pockets, I would call it. And we also, because of the valuable asset, what it's actually called, the NHI system, is a national health asset, as it's called. So it sits within the Ministry of Health, and it's their role as the overarching custodian of it. And that's rightly how it should be. As a result of that, you know, the actual use of data sets and so forth is very closely guarded. And then, of course, we have, you know, whether it's the Microsofts, the AWS, and we've got, you know, Orion Health, we've got a plethora actually of localized, whether they're international entities that are operating in New Zealand or the New Zealand entities, like Orion, you know, who operates offshore as well, is quite considerable export footprint. Of course, all this data is sitting in there, and the development of an interoperable kind of environment, which would enable the flow of data and use of data in the terms that you're talking, is gaining momentum, but we've still got a long way to go. In 2016, I sort of led the development of what we called the New Zealand Vision for Interoperability. Anybody that's actually, they could go to our website, so nzhit.nz, and one of the tabs running along the top has got resources, and they could go in there. I think it might be under sector reports or something like that. You'll be able to access a copy of it from there. Using my sort of colloquialism, it's been a slow burn since 2016, and that it hasn't made the progress that we would have liked at the time. But it's kind of, sometimes these things have their day, and we're starting to see now a resurgence of the understanding that there needs to be some principles associated with interoperability, so that we all understand what's required and operate within sort of a safe environment. And then the Ministry of Health, our Ministry of Health here, is been developing a what they're calling a roadmap for interoperability, or may well be interoperability roadmap, one or the other. And part of what we developed in 2016 has been incorporated into that. So it's effectively being modernized. And we're also working with the Australian Digital Health Agency. When I say we, our Ministry of Health, and because they're also on that kind of pathway as well. So we're, you know, there's a sort of sharing of information and knowledge set as well. Interoperability is kind of one of those holy grails, and we're working quite hard on it. It's digital identity has become a kind of, let's say, an overarching discussion, which then forces the development or, you know, what is interoperability going to do to help with digital identity. And you get this, what we're calling in New Zealand, a kind of a set of digital enablers. So interoperability by itself just doesn't sit there and you solve that problem and all other problems are solved. There's a digital enablers incorporate the likes of digital identity, interoperability, security, privacy, and a number of other areas, even just your standard IT infrastructure. Because if that's not right, then doesn't matter what I call bright, shiny things you want to put on top of it, you know, it's still not going to work properly if the infrastructure that can't stand it up.
You know, it a lot of really great nuggets there and so many different important things that you are working on. I am curious, since the COVID-19 pandemic, if these discussions have accelerated or modified the level of importance or speed or focus on anything that you have shared. I wanted to bring up specifically the issue around things like contact tracing. I know that in Canada and the US, there's been lots of opportunities using Bluetooth devices, and there's all kinds of shielding on, you know, what data is shared or not. And despite all of that, there's still reticence to using these very highly efficient and cost-effective applications because of concerns of security and privacy and what you're sort of deeming as digital identities. How much of this is part of a generalized population of misunderstanding about data, what should be shared, what is owned, what is actually processed by some of these data lake engineers? So what can you say around some of the concern and the difficulty in adoption, and what have you seen as accelerated since COVID-19?
In that area, in New Zealand, I guess firstly I'd say that we demonstrated when we first went into lockdown, so we're sort of talking early March this year, of course, that when we went into full lockdown, the majority, and our Prime Minister and lots of us proudly sort of talk about the team of 5 million, which is effectively our population, and the fact that we actually just the vast majority of us just kind of did what it took to go into lockdown and do, you know, kinda, let's say, abide by the rules and just behave in a way that care is what I would call, and I don't want to become sort of apple pie here, but sort of like do what it takes to kind of care for, you know, your fellow citizens and for the country, and understand that this is something that we none of us have ever experienced before, and so it's going to be tough and it's going to be unsettling and all of those things, and we certainly did well. We did very well, of course, because we sort of came up until just a couple of days ago, 2 days ago, we'd had about 102 days of no community transmission. That's really good. And we're patting ourselves on the back for, you know, this great team of 5 million. However, there had also, as a result, sort of developed this kind of a complacency, you know, and even our government and our Ministry of Health was kind of starting to warn that, you know, we were getting too complacent, and because our testing, our community testing was continuing, but numbers of people being prepared to be tested was dropping. We have a New Zealand contact tracing app to download, onto our mobiles, and that was developed by the Ministry of Health, and we had some of our members were involved in that as well, and we were also involved in part of the standards development. That all had that happen very quickly, in order as we were coming, we'd gone into the lockdown level, then we were coming down the levels. So we were going to basically come into level one, and which was sort of the, you know, getting close back to no levels at all, but with a few kind of restrictions. And the contact tracing app was kind of very fast track to be available once we come into level one. And it wasn't all bells and whistles, because it never was going to be. And there was quite a bit of angst, I suppose, in the media, particularly, I would say, really fired up by the media to a high degree, about contact tracing and the fact that Singapore was doing something and Taiwan was doing something and Australia was doing something. Why weren't we doing all of those things? And, you know, we've got to have this contact tracing, but you know, the ministry and the government seem to be dragging the chain, as we call it here. And so as a result of that, also what kind of fired up was people's worry and concern, angst about privacy and security. And it's a very difficult, you know, like it's a balancing act, isn't it? So I have to say, you know, I had some stern words for some reporters that were ringing me at the time and saying, look, actually, ultimately, we're coming out of lockdown. We've done extremely well as a country when it comes to identifying who's got an infection and contact tracing all the way back to the source. With a very manual system, it was effectively people on the phone and ringing and just identifying and then getting people tested and into isolation. And we did very well at that. And of course, coming out of lockdown, you have a less controlled environment. So then having digital enabler like a contact tracing app was going to be very important. And so where I'm heading with this was that I think any society gets concerned, you know, and particularly in a Western society, gets concerned about something that appears to be going to track and trace us. And I think it's very difficult to alleviate everybody's fears. So then you get, people who, and it will be a minority of people who will, without question, will download the app and use the app. And then, of course, it comes down to the functionality of the app. We are probably only not quite sitting at 20% of people with mobile phones. So it's not all about the total population, because not everybody's got a mobile, but people with mobile phones, I think we must be sitting at about 20% have the app, and it's been getting improved. When it first came out, all you could do was scan a QR code on the premises, and not all the premises had QR codes. So there was a bit of problems associated with that, and not all businesses even now have QR codes. The app had recently got updated so that you could actually manually enter where you had been and what you had done. And that was really good. But you also had to force the update. So it wasn't sort of an automatic update for an app. So where I'm heading with this actually is I don't think we've experienced anything too different to any other country. We had a very, a compliant population going into lockdown, yet it hasn't reflected in total compliance to downloading the app. And I don't think it would be expected to happen, because that's I don't think it's human behavior that you're going to get full compliance unless you absolutely make it compulsory. And there's either rewards or punishment if you do or you don't. But what we've now just seen, and I'm sorry about this long story, but of course, in recent times, the last 2 days, so I mentioned that we hadn't had any community transmission for about, I think, 102 days, but 2 days ago, we've had that. So we're now Auckland, where I live, the greater Auckland area has gone into what we call level three. So we've kind of gone from level one, jumped over the top of level two and into level three. So we're close to going back into full lockdown. And the rest of the country has gone from level one to level two. And so and people can go to the Ministry of Health website, kind of describes what those levels mean. As a result, there's been an uptake of the use of downloading the app and the use of the app. And that's cool. The government, the Prime Minister here, just announced yesterday that businesses have been given 1 week to comply, but it is going to become law or compulsory for all businesses to display a QR code. And that will help, because a lot of people have been saying to me, well, I've downloaded the app, but there's no QR codes, you know? And some of the stuff's happened a bit late than you would probably think it should, but also when populations get complacent, you know, you sort of get used to, you know, almost back to the way of life you had before lockdown. It's sort of it's very difficult to convince people they should still be concerned and they should still be doing these things. So I'm not quite sure whether I answered your question, but we, you know, we in New Zealand, even now, like in Auckland, I won't say all the population. It's obviously the biggest city in New Zealand. You know, well over 1. I'm not sure the exact population. It's 1.2 million or something like that. For a country with 5 million people, you know, it's the most population dense part of the country, and we've got checkpoints on our borders, you know, in and out of the city now. The boundaries, and Aucklanders aren't supposed to be leaving Auckland unless you are an essential worker or you've got a permit to leave. And I use the word permit advisedly, of course. And you should only be coming into Auckland if you really absolutely need to.
Okay, that's fantastic. I think that's a good overview. So, so just moving along, Scott. I think what's also an interesting question is, you know, in this post-COVID or during whatever you want to say, wherever we happen to be with this pandemic, it's just part of the new normal. Is have you seen, you know, through NZ Hit or through conversations with your partners, an acceleration of in consideration of other new novel digital technologies in the healthcare space, be it telehealth or other sorts of, you know, applications? I know that in Canada, you know, through Health Canada, as well as in the US with the FDA, there's been an acceleration of approvals of things like digital therapeutics and software as a medical device. Has that taken place in New Zealand, and has COVID accelerated that? And what has been the environment, and how is NZ Hit helping to advocate for some of those changes?
Specifically in the area of telehealth, or some might call it virtual health, predominantly it's called telehealth in New Zealand. We've seen, you know, we saw going into lockdown or in lockdown, the just a massive upsurge of the use of telehealth technologies to support and enable, you know, care provision. And one of the biggest accelerants of that was that the fact that GPs, you know, primary care doctors with who are predominantly bricks and mortar based businesses, so they have patients come into their surgery and see them. That hasn't been a very strong use of telehealth in the primary care sector in New Zealand. We had been NZ Hit in association with an organisation which is set up and sponsored by the Ministry of Health, and it's called the Telehealth Leadership Group. We have been for quite some time advocating the use of telehealth. It's fairly well defined and used at secondary care level, so sort of hospital to hospital or clinic to clinic, some multidisciplinary team type telehealth type use of that, but at secondary care level, and not so widespread in primary care. So the doctors, basically, effectively GPs, I think we were about 2 weeks into lockdown, and GPs were told they had to shut their doors. So they only were to see patients in person there was no other way to provide them with care. And of course, if they were thinking that they had COVID or flu-like symptoms, whatever, they would need to be seen to be tested. Effectively in primary care, you close the doors of the clinic, well then what are you going to do? And they got forced GPs to so very quickly, and in some cases just do what it took, really, because they weren't prepared for it. If they hadn't been using that as a part of their business model or their process to support their model of care, then it was kind of like, gosh, we've got 2 days to close our doors. And those 2 days were the weekend. So they had to have their doors closed by the Monday. Many of them reverted to telephone. They weren't set up for video conferencing. So those that were started a combination of video conferencing, video consults and on the phone. A lot of it was driven by the patient. So what was the patient able to use and most comfortable using? And of course, as a patient, if you hadn't been used to even conversing with your doctor, having a consult with your doctor on the telephone, that was an unusual experience, and also for the doctor. So what happened, of course, I think they wanted GPs to reduce in-person consults by, I think it's sort of something like 20 or 30%. Many GPs, whether it was just predominantly using a phone or a combination of phone and video, they got it up to sort of those consults, virtual consults, telehealth consults, you know, sort of to 70 to 80%, which was really good. And considering that they weren't set up to do it. So I think that sort of demonstrated the commitment of the GP, or the, and it's not just about the GP, it's their nurses, it's their whole staff of running that business. Having to very quickly, you know, we use a kind of a pivot word, kind of a little bit overuse it nowadays, but kind of very quickly pivot enough, mostly so that obviously so they could continue to provide care. So that ramped up really quickly. And in behind that had to be a lot of changes, sort of regulatory type changes. We've got what we call the New Zealand Electronic Prescribing Service, so NZEPS for short, which had kind of been, I would say, meandering along for quite some time. I think it was sitting at about less than 20% of GPs had registered and were on the NZEPS system, which would enable them to generate an electronic prescription. Most were still printing out the prescription, the script, handing it to their patient, who would take it to their local pharmacy of their choice to get it filled. Part of that was driven by what we call the wet signature, so the doctor having to sign the script, which is legislatively required. But NZEPS had provided a sort of an exemption system that if you went on the EPS and you met certain criteria, you could get an exemption from the Director General of Health that you didn't have to have the wet signature. But many hadn't kind of, let's say, bothered. It was just, it sort of wasn't high profile, it wasn't on top of mind for them. But of course, going into virtual consults and telehealth and so forth, they couldn't print out and give their patient a script, you know. So in behind with the Ministry of Health and the telehealth leadership group that I mentioned, and the New Zealand College of GPs, there was an enormous, fantastic effort to kind of break down some what in a way had been seen as kind of impenetrable barriers, because some of them were legislative, and some of them were kind of, let's say, had developed barriers that had developed over many, many years that people thought were regulatory, but in actual fact were just the way that we do stuff, you know. And so we had to sort of break down a lot of that suddenly actually that it really wasn't regulatory. It was just the way that it had always been done. So it had become embedded. Those had to be broke down very quickly. So we were able relatively quickly to bring the doctors, GPs that were on the NZEPS program from sort of 20% up to, I think it's currently sitting at around about 85%. So we've had this massive upsurge, which is fantastic. And it had, you know, pharmacies had already kind of adopted it quite quickly and quite well, but the main kind of inhibitor was GPs hadn't got onto it. But if they wanted to continue to prescribe for their patients via telehealth, they had to, but it had to be made easier for them to do. So lots of effort. It was an amazing amount of effort.
There's a lot of great regulatory and other sorts of changes. It sounds like that's been fantastic, and you've slowly been getting physicians within the area slowly, you know, as maybe lady doctors. I guess COVID-19 has kind of pushed the agenda forward, which is interesting. Some other things that we noticed with NZHIT is that you've got some really interesting special interest groups. So I'm just curious about some of the other offerings that you provide to your members, and basically why they would want to join in the first place. Is, you know, it looks like there's some other things that you help to sort of spearhead, everything from the e-mental health industry group to the virtual health industry group to the digital enablers and industry group. So how are your members benefiting from these special interest groups, and what is the core focus? Is it for networking? Is it for business deals? Is it for government advocacy? What is the perspective and point of these special interest groups?
I think overarching everything, firstly, is kind of I've kind of three, let's say, mantras that I focus on in delivering value for members. And the first one is sort of get engaged. And second is get connected. And then thirdly, get involved. So, and I have what I call sort of a very, I guess, I focus on making sure that my members are active. So, you know, you get inactive, any membership organization, whether it's it might be a local ice hockey club, or in your case there, in our case, it might be our rugby club or whatever, you will have your active members and you'll have your inactive members, or less engaged members. And so I try very hard to make sure that all members are engaged and connected and involved at the levels that suits them. And so that requires sort of an individual focus across the membership, and a member may be quite engaged in something, but not in something else. And that's fine, because that's probably their area of interest. Some members get involved in everything, and that's fantastic. And they may at some point stop being so involved. And part of what I try to do is notice that and have a chat with them. Quite often it's just simply because they've got so busy, and that they just can't be as involved as they used to be. Sometimes it's actually something's not resonating with them. So then finding that out, having a chat really, and saying, okay, have we missed the mark with something? What can we do to help? So coming back to those interest groups, as our membership started to grow in numbers, what I found, it became more difficult to individually know and engage with every member. You know, which is what I was doing, still try to do. The interest groups then started to form because it was enabled me to aggregate members into certain areas of interest or activity. And generally, those came out of there may be a problem in the sector that I had identified, or members would come to me and say, well, we've got a problem. And individually, they've got a problem. But then when you aggregate and try to solve that problem themselves, they've not been able to make any traction. So then they say, well, why don't we aggregate or combine, get our strength of voice and numbers sitting within NZ HIT anyway, but let's try to solve this problem. And that's where, yeah, the virtual health industry group came kind of from that, because I'm the industry representative on the, what I called earlier, the telehealth leadership group. So and what I increasingly found was, it was as that group grew, I was the sole voice around that table for industry. And I wanted to have kind of the kind of evidence, I suppose, of the things that I said were evidenced by the backing of my members. It wasn't just stuff that Scott Arrell was making up because it sounded good. And so then I formed the virtual health industry group. So I got members together who were actively and growing. There was a growing group of members in telehealth, virtual health. So formed that one. So that the chair now of that group, who currently is a chap called Samuel Wong, he's also now joined the telehealth leadership group as the chair. So it's two of us on that group, and we can, and it's a collaborative engagement model with the telehealth leadership group, and by that through into the Ministry of Health. So that's helped with that. The e-mental health industry group has just been formed, I think only about 3 months ago. That's part of the growth of the development of e-mental health kinds, digital solutions to support the delivery of mental health and addiction services. And I noticed a growing number of members getting either joining because they were in that space, or existing members getting into that space. So, and the Ministry of Health have a fantastic person called Robin Shearer. She's the Deputy Director General for Mental Health and Addiction. And I know her reasonably well from her previous work. And it was sort of bringing this group together to say, hey, here's a group of industry players who are active in this area, and they want to engage with the Ministry of Health and any others in the public sector to advance that area. Make sure that industry is not being kept at such an arm's length that when you're talking about things like digital frameworks and so forth, that we should be part of those conversations and co-developing, not left to the last minute. And the digital enabler one, I mentioned that earlier, that sprung out of actually an issue that developed nearly 2 years ago over security and privacy. where some members who are very active in that area were kind of getting, I guess, coerced in a way to update the some of the public health providers kind of wanted the latest and greatest and when it came to cybersecurity and privacy software, but weren't prepared to pay what they should be paying. And some of them were using systems that were quite old and weren't updating them. Yet they expected the industry players just to come along and update them. And they should do that for free, because if they didn't, then there's kind of, there was a bit of a unsaid threat that if you don't do it, I'll get someone else to do it. So we kind of, we aggregated that group so that we could have a bit of, again, positive tension on that conversation. And fortunately, it did work to a degree, because both parties kind of reached the midpoint. And that's then enabled us to, we formed that group as digital enablers, because you can't talk about cybersecurity or privacy on its own, because you talk about digital identity and interoperability and all those other good things that come with it.
Yeah, I think so. I really like the way that you've really holistically viewed things in a very systems thinking way, as opposed to just going to a, like you said, just a really just talking about cybersecurity or just talking about digital identity. You're really looking at it from a very systemic thinking, which is very provocative and very forward thinking. Now, I guess because of COVID-19, probably the typical ways that you've been engaging in the membership through probably in-person events and all sorts of other networking sorts of things, how has this evolved for you? How has this impacted membership in a positive or negative way? And tell us a little bit about why you started the podcast that you did.
Oh, well, let me start there first. It was sort of, I guess, again, that systemized way of thinking. I was sort of trying to, going into lockdown, so pre-lockdown, and let's say for, you know, close to what are we now, 18 years of in business, so to speak, you know, our predominant method of engaging with members was very traditional in person, either events or one-on-one meetings with me or small group meetings. It was always in person, and generally around a coffee or a beer or anything like that. And then newsletters and the website, those type, yeah, very traditional, of course. And of course, when you can't do that, what do? You either, when we first went into lockdown, I thought, well, there's two things I can do, is we can just basically go into hibernation and wait to whenever lockdown stops, and we'll put on an event and we'll have a few beers and wines together, you know. Then I thought, well, I don't know how long that's going to be. So the other choice was to actively work out how to continue to engage. So coming back to what I said, you know, so get engaged, get connected, get involved. So I apply that to me as much as I apply it to my members. So then saying, okay, well then, you know, how can I get my members and anybody else that wants to? So I kind of took a view of, first and foremost, it's about, I'm here to provide benefit and value to my membership. And in doing that, it will have a flow on effect to others. And ultimately it should have a flow on effect, a positive effect to the sector, the health sector. And so then saying, how do I get members engaged when I can't do this age-old thing of getting in front of them personally? So we've got the technology, so why not use that? And we were already starting to do a lot of kind of our board, for example, which is an elected board by the membership, you know, we were starting to do more sort of Zoom or predominantly Teams meetings anyway. So that was pretty simple. So say, okay, well, I'll get some... What I wanted to avoid was just being a me too when it came to webinars, and all due respect to webinars, it's not but a lot of my, let's say, counterparts and other associations kind of said, oh, we're just going to do heaps of webinars, nearly every association that I know in the sector and not outside of the sector, you know, we're doing webinars. And I'm saying there's no problem with that, except I could see that we were going to reach peak webinar fairly quickly, and people would just be over it, you know. Now, if you're sitting at home and you're working from home, you know, it got to a point in New Zealand, probably elsewhere too, where, you know, you could be on a webinar nearly all day, every day of the week. You know? And I've sort of started to get quoted as saying, you know, whenever lockdown finishes, we're going to be the most knowledgeable and intelligent population in the whole world, you know. It's, and so I just, you needed a little bit of a point of difference. So I just, I created what I, and this isn't new stuff. It wasn't me coming up with something that had never been thought of before. But instead of a webinar, I just called it, you know, like an after work drinks get together. So just thinking, well, what did we used to do? Taking those themes that would be as an in-person type thing, but then just transcribing it over to a virtual thing. So then saying, okay, well, we're going to have these Thursday night get-togethers over a drink, of course, bring your own. And I called it that when you did that, of course, you're bringing your own drinks or whatever. You earned, by doing that, you earned NZ Hit virtual credits, which really just meant that when we do get back together in person, I'll buy the drinks. and that generated, you know, we would started doing that weekly. I got some guest speakers, so I got some people that were, you know, kind of, you would, because of COVID, it made them more available as well. So people that would not normally come and speak at a in-person event, they've suddenly, that they were quite available, and they were very pleased to be speakers. And but it was very much done on a casual basis, and people could ask questions and comment as they went. The other thing, and they went very well. We started off weekly and I reduced those to fortnightly. I didn't then stop doing them because there were too many other, there was too much overcrowding in that going on, even though mine were a little bit different. The webinars at some of my other organizations, associations in the health sector, were actually better quality, if I put it that way. And so I wanted to encourage members to connect into those. So coming back to that kind of connection side, so I just wanted to reduce the noise a bit, but it filled a gap while it was there. And the other thing that has continued happening has been very popular, which was quite surprising, was what I called our Spill the Beans with Scott sessions, which is really just a morning tea, as we call it in New Zealand. Get together again, bring your own coffee or tea or biscuits. And we were just using Teams to connect and get people engaged. And it started off weekly every Thursday at 10 o'clock. We're still doing them now, gone to fortnightly. And originally it was just join in and have a chat, and in doing that, people were sort of starting to talk about how they felt. For example, Kiwis are a little bit circumspect. We don't talk about how we're feeling very well. And but I found that, and I thought it would be even less so when you were doing it virtually with a group of people. But people weren't opening up totally. But we started to talk about, well, you know, the sort of feelings of uncertainty, and kind of some people were feeling overwhelmed because, you know, it became, you know, it was almost like email after email after email. Everyone suddenly was sitting at their desk for 8 hours a day at home. Some of them were sitting in their kitchen bench on their laptops. It was a very different world that people were living in. So they proved really popular. And as we came down the levels and into level one, I pushed them out to fortnightly and gave them a topic. So we had one this morning before I joined this session. And the topic was about cybersecurity and privacy. So people who have a very particular interest in that area, they joined in.
And that's fantastic.
And there's some good banter. You'd know the word banter, I suppose. Yes. Kiwis and Australians are probably... Yeah, we pride ourselves on our banter. We would say Australians don't do it as well as New Zealanders. But, so there's always a little bit of banter and a bit of friendly nudging and poking in the ribs, as I call it. And then somewhere in between all that, we talk about a serious topic.
That's awesome. I absolutely love it. I could actually talk to you for hours, Scott. What a wonderful organization you have definitely built and created with the special interest groups. You've got a great group of people. I love the innovation, especially you know, bringing some normalcy and some community, if you will, during this really unstable time. And so it's very inspiring. And I think other people globally can capture a lot of really interesting insights. New Zealand, a smaller country, but some really interesting ideas around you know, the digital identity, the sort of centralized database, how this can be leveraged, you know, how to get communities together. So I think you shared some ideas that can be very inspirational to people. So thank you so much for this. For those people who are interested in potentially connecting with Scott, we'll be leaving all of his contact details in the show notes and as well as in our blog. So be on the lookout for those. for anybody who's interested in having some of these courageous conversations, who are interested in doing some of these leading edge things, doing things a little different, nudging people and individuals and physicians and other healthcare stakeholders in a forward direction. This is really what Impetus does with our asynchronous and synchronous virtual collaboration tools. We want to be the bridge for these, some of these beyond the pill conversations. And how do we, again, move the agenda forward in healthcare and get ourselves accelerated in the digital space? So please contact us if you're interested in doing more of that. So thank you, Scott, so much for your time today. Wishing you a wonderful day. And also everybody who's attended and everybody who's listening, thank you so much, and wishing everybody a wonderful day forward.
Thank you very much. And I really appreciate the opportunity and the time that you've spent today. And I didn't even get to talk much about the podcast channel, but you gave the details. So jump in there. Particularly everyone that wants to listen to, you know, the most important accent in the world. Why wouldn't you, you know?
thanks very much, everybody. Have a great day.
Great. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Healthcare Goes Digital podcast. Impetus Digital are the business-to-business advisory board experts and provide virtual collaboration solutions for meetings, events, and projects worldwide. Visit us at impetusdigital.com to find out more and subscribe to our LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube to stay up to date about other upcoming inspiring conversations.